Every year, Los Angeles public schools quietly lose millions of dollars in funding. And the crazy thing is, the money isn't vanishing into some bureaucratic black hole.
Right. It's not being mismanaged by administrators or anything like that.
Exactly. It is directly subsidizing the luxury remodels of multi-million dollar downtown condos.
Yeah.
And it is all completely 100% legal.
Yeah. The mechanism that actually allows this is, well, it's a perfect case study in how a policy's noble intent can just become entirely divorced from its mechanical reality over time.
It really is. So welcome to today's deep dive into the source material. We are unpacking a 2022 equity analysis commissioned by the city of Los Angeles regarding something called the Mills Act.
Right, the Mills Act.
And our mission today is to look at how a genuinely well-intentioned policy designed to save historic architecture just went completely off the rails. We're going to look at who is actually pocketing this money and the five specific ways the city is trying to fix the loopholes.
It's a fascinating ledger to dig into, for sure.
So to set the stage for you, the listener, the easiest way to understand this is to imagine passing a hat around your neighborhood to help a struggling mom-and-pop diner fix a caved-in roof.
Okay, I like this analogy.
Right. But instead of giving them the collection money, the city just takes the cash and hands it to a Michelin star restaurant so they can upgrade their crystal chandeliers.
Yeah, that pretty much nails it. And to see exactly how we ended up subsidizing those chandeliers, we really have to look at the mechanics of the policy in California.
Let's unpack that.
So if you look at the backdrop behind me, you'll see this mix of historic cityscapes and, you know, dense policy ledgers, which is the exact intersection where this story takes place. The Mills Act is a state law, specifically California Government Code Sections 50280 through 50290, and it was enacted way back in 1972.
And LA adopted it later, right?
Yeah. Los Angeles officially brought it into their own city framework in 1996. The core idea authorized cities to enter into these 10-year property tax contracts with the owners of qualified historic properties.
Which, I mean, the underlying logic makes sense on paper. Restoring a historic home to its original period standards is incredibly expensive.
Oh, absolutely.
You can't just slap cheap vinyl siding on an Art Deco masterpiece. So the city offers a tax break to offset those premium preservation costs.
Exactly. In exchange for that tax break, the owner agrees to maintain the property to very defined historical standards. To even be eligible in LA, a property has to be designated as a historic cultural monument or be a contributor to a historic preservation overlay zone or be listed on the National Register.
Okay, so it has to be legitimately historic.
Right. But the crucial element here, the real engine driving the massive financial disparities we're going to discuss, is how the county assessor actually calculates that tax break. When an owner secures a Mills Act contract, their property is no longer assessed based on its market value.
Wait, so the assessor essentially just ignores what the building would actually sell for on the open market today?
Yep. The market value is taken entirely out of the equation. Instead, the state mandates that assessors use what's called a capitalized income method.
Okay, what does that mean in plain English?
It basically means they look at the rental income or the potential imputed rental income that the property generates. Then they work backward using this specific, highly generous statutory formula to create a sort of pseudo-value for the property on paper.
Because rent prices, well, obviously super high in California, they haven't appreciated at the same astronomical exponential rate as actual property values over the last 30 years.
Exactly. So the resulting capitalized income value almost always sits roughly 30 to 80% below the actual market value of the property.
Wow.
Yeah. And the owner's tax bill drops in exact proportion to that artificial reduction. And it gets better for them because in Los Angeles, these 10-year contracts automatically renew every single year unless the owner takes the proactive step to file a non-renewal notice.
So the duration of this massive tax cut is effectively indefinite.
Pretty much, yeah.
I mean, think about your own property tax bill for a second. Yeah. Now imagine slashing it by up to 80% indefinitely without ever having to reapply.
It's quite the deal.
Which brings us to the central question of this 2022 equity analysis by AECOM. Because if the stated goal of the Mills Act is to save buildings at risk of deterioration, we should see this money flowing to under-resourced neighborhoods. Right. Places where an owner genuinely needs the public's financial help to keep a historic building from falling down.
You'd think so. But the AECOM data paints a starkly different picture of the 2019 ledger. At that time, Los Angeles had 929 active Mills Act contracts.
Okay.
And together, those contracts generated $20.09 million in annual property tax savings for the owners. Mm. AECOM actually used an equity index to score each property's census tract based on access to opportunity.
Like what kind of metrics?
Things like local jobs, quality of schools, transit access, and environmental burden. So they segmented the entire city into four tiers, from high barriers, meaning the lowest resource neighborhoods, all the way up to low barriers, which are the wealthiest, highest resource neighborhoods.
Right. And here is where the data just gets wild. Out of that entire $20 million pie, a staggering 82.6% of the subsidy flows directly to properties located in the two highest resource tiers.
Yeah, it's incredibly skewed. And the high barriers tracks, so the lowest resource neighborhoods in the entire city, they receive exactly 1.1% of the savings.
1.1%. It is an incredible inversion of where public assistance is typically designed to go.
What's fascinating here is that this highlights a fundamental flaw in the assumption of the program as it operates today. The public is essentially funding preservation in neighborhoods where preservation was never actually in jeopardy.
Right, because in a highly resourced, wealthy area, if a historic building needs a new roof, the alternative to a public tax subsidy is just private capital.
Exactly. The owner pays for it out of pocket, or some developer buys it and remodels it for a massive profit. The option of just letting a multi-million dollar landmark in a premium zip code rot and fall down, that was never on the table.
And this isn't just monopoly money moving around on a spreadsheet, you know. This is $20 million in unrealized revenue every single year. So what does this all mean for your tax dollars?
Well, the source material breaks down exactly who shoulders the burden of this missing money. The city of Los Angeles eats about 11% of the loss, which is roughly $2.18 million.
Okay.
But the true casualty here is the school system. Los Angeles schools lose roughly 35% of that revenue. The county loses about 30%, and the rest hits various special districts like fire or transit.
So millions of dollars are quietly drained from public education budgets to subsidize remodels in the richest parts of the city. But I want to push back on this a little, or at least ask, why is it so concentrated? Is it just a coincidence of geography? Like, do historic single-family mansions just happen to be located in wealthy enclaves?
It's a great question, but no, the geographic concentration actually stems from a mechanical reality of the property types being subsidized. And this dynamic is perfectly illustrated by Council District 14, which encompasses downtown LA, Boyle Heights, and Eagle Rock.
Okay, what's happening in District 14?
That single district absorbs 50% of the entire city's Mills Act subsidy. $10 million a year flows into just one council district.
Wow. Okay, I want to look at the data breakdown here because single-family homes make up 70.8% of all the active contracts in the city. If they're over 70% of the participants, but the total drain is $20 million, the average single-family home clearly isn't the primary issue.
No, not at all. The median single-family home contract saves its owner about $7,600 a year. They account for the vast majority of the contracts, but only a quarter of the actual financial savings.
So where is the money going?
The overwhelming drain on the system is driven by condominiums. There are only 26 condominium contracts in the entire city, yet they consume 33% of all the savings.
Wait, 26 contracts hold a third of the money?
Yep. Those 26 condo contracts average $255,170 in tax breaks every single year.
Here's where it gets really interesting for anyone looking at the ledger. The source details a histogram of the savings distribution. At the very bottom, you have 154 small contracts that save the owner under $1,000 a year. Combined, they make up just 0.1% of the total savings. It's essentially administrative noise.
Right.
But at the top end of the spectrum, just 36 massive contracts hold 63.3% of the entire $20 million pie.
Yeah, that pattern is not marginal. It is the defining characteristic of the program. The bulk of the public's money is flowing to adaptive reuse conversions of downtown commercial landmarks. A prime example from the data is the Eastern Columbia Building at 849 South Broadway.
Oh, the iconic turquoise Art Deco building.
That's the one. It is a stunning piece of architecture, and it is also the number one Mills Act contract in the city. In 2019, that single property pulled in $930,382 in tax savings in 1 year. The property's trended value that year was $128.5 million.
Mm-hmm.
And the mechanism here is that a massive historic building is converted into individual luxury condo units, and then each of those individual units holds its own subcontract.
Wait, so let me get this straight. A developer buys a massive downtown landmark, converts it into hundreds of luxury condos, sells them for a fortune, and each individual condo owner gets a perpetual tax break.
That's how it works.
It's like finding a loophole at an all-you-can-eat buffet and bringing a fleet of Tupperware containers. Like, the preservation already happened, the profit was already made. Why are taxpayers still paying them nearly $1 million a year?
Well, the outrage over that perpetual subsidy brings us to what is arguably the most structurally broken component of the Mills Act in Los Angeles. The real issue isn't just who is getting the break today, it's what happens tomorrow when these properties are sold to new owners.
The perpetual nature of the Tupperware.
Exactly. If we connect this to the bigger picture of California tax law, we have to factor in Proposition 13.
Right, the infamous Prop 13.
Right. So under Prop 13, a property's assessed value is generally locked in at the time of purchase, and it's only allowed to increase by a tiny fraction each year, regardless of how much the actual real estate market booms. But crucially, when a property is sold, that assessed value is supposed to reset to the new current market purchase price.
Right. The new buyer pays taxes based on the premium price they just negotiated.
Under normal circumstances, yes, but a Mills Act contract travels with the property itself, not the owner who find it. If a buyer purchases a parcel with an active Mills Act restriction on it, they inherit that massive tax abatement automatically.
Wait, there's no application process for the new buyer? No city official checking the equity index to see if this new multimillionaire needs public assistance to maintain their loft?
None. The new owner undergoes absolutely no revetting against the original maintenance plan, and they are required to provide zero proof that they actually need a subsidy to maintain the building. They acquire the discount entirely by default.
Think about that. You, the taxpayer, working a normal job, are subsidizing a new buyer who just purchased a multi-million-dollar loft, and no one from the city even checks if they plan to do any historic restoration. They just get the discount automatically.
And the data on post-transfer ownership is staggering. The report identified 391 contracts where the property changed hands after the initial historic restoration contract was signed. The current owners simply inherited the abatement from the seller.
Wow.
Those 391 contracts account for 66.1% of all the annual savings. That is $13.28 million out of the $20 million total flowing to post-transfer owners who never initiated a preservation plan.
So two-thirds of the entire program's cost is funding inherited windfalls.
Exactly. It creates a severe structural asymmetry. It's essentially a double abatement for the wealthiest, most market-active players in real estate. A buyer acquires the property, they get their Prop 13 baseline reset to a lower capitalized income value, and they inherit an open-ended Mills Act contract that just auto-renews.
Okay, this paints an incredibly bleak picture of a system operating as an unvetted, uncapped free-for-all. I have to ask, is LA alone in this? Because clearly, the math needs fixing. But the city also needs to ensure they don't accidentally punish the small, well-intentioned homeowner who relies on their modest $800 tax break to fix their bungalow's roof.
Right, you don't want to crush the little guys.
Exactly. So how are other California cities managing this, and how does Los Angeles plan to stop the bleeding?
Well, Los Angeles is a distinct outlier in how loosely it administers the program. The report contrasts LA with several other major jurisdictions. For example, San Francisco looked at the financial dynamics and opted out of the Mills Act entirely.
They just don't use it.
Right. They simply do not offer a property tax abatement layer for preservation. They rely on different regulatory tools and federal historic tax credits instead.
Okay, what about other cities?
Pasadena utilizes the Mills Act, but they impose strict caps on the assessed value reduction. Furthermore, they actively reject contracts if the 10-year maintenance plan does not demonstrate a clear financial need for the public subsidy. Because of those safeguards, Pasadena only carries about 90 active contracts citywide.
A fraction of LA's volume.
Exactly. San Diego maintains a massive program with roughly 1,300 contracts, but they strictly enforce sunset reviews. The contracts still auto-renew, but city staff perform a structured, mandatory review of any contract where the property has changed hands or where the initial maintenance plan has concluded.
So they're actually checking in on them?
Yes. They actively decide if the contract should be flagged for non-renewal. Meanwhile, Los Angeles currently operates with no income test, no renewal review, and no cap on the financial savings.
So the source outlines a 2025 amendments deck designed to overhaul this system. How do these proposed reforms target the structural flaws without ruining the program for those legitimate preservationists?
The proposed amendments are actually an elegant piece of policy engineering. They offer five distinct paths to reform.
Let's hear it.
The first is equity tier eligibility. Moving forward, the city would restrict the issuance of new contracts exclusively to properties located in the lower resource neighborhoods, the medium to high or high barriers tiers.
Oh, that makes sense. That immediately stops the bleeding into the wealthiest, highest resource census tracts.
Yeah.
The private capital in those areas will just have to fund its own renovations.
Right. And existing contracts in those high resource tiers would simply be set to non-renew at the end of their current 10-year term, phasing them out gradually.
Okay, what's the second reform?
The second is a means-tested cap on annual savings. The proposal suggests capping the annual per contract savings at a multiple of the city's median property tax bill. For example, capping the savings at 4 times the median bill. Any calculated tax reduction above that strict cap simply returns to the public assessor.
See, that is a brilliant mechanical fix. We established earlier that there's like 154 small contracts that save under a grand. A median multiple cap wouldn't touch the average single-family bungalow at all, but it absolutely kneecaps those top 36 massive condo and commercial contracts hoarding 63% of the money.
Precisely. It solves the top-heavy distribution problem instantly.
Nice. And the third?
The third reform targets the Prop 13 loophole directly, non-renewal on transfer. When a Mills Act property changes ownership, the contract will no longer transfer automatically. The new owner must reapply and demonstrate their own financial need or present a specific new restoration scope.
Goodbye to the automatic fleet of Tupperware. If you want the buffet, you have to prove you actually need the food. That single change addresses the $13.28 million currently flowing to post-transfer owners.
Exactly. Then the fourth reform introduces performance reporting. Because, believe it or not, under the current system, zero contracts actually report their restoration spending to the public.
Wait, really? The city distributes $20 million a year in tax subsidies and never even asks for a receipt.
Zero receipts are collected. The new rule would mandate every contract to annually report its 10-year restoration plan, the completion percentage of those projects, and the actual capital spent to the Office of Historic Resources.
That just seems like basic common sense for any public grant. Show your work.
Yeah, and if an owner fails to deliver the scheduled preservation work, they get flagged for immediate non-renewal. The city identified this accountability measure as their highest leverage proposed change.
Okay, and what is the fifth and final reform?
The fifth proposal is a restoration cost ratio requirement. For any contract that sits above that new means-tested cap we discussed, the owner would be legally required to spend a minimum percentage of the property's overall value, say 5%, on actual historic restoration over the 10-year term.
Okay, so if you get a massive tax break, you actually have to spend big on restoration.
Right. If they cannot demonstrate they are executing preservation work of that massive scale, they must either voluntarily reduce their tax savings draw or face non-renewal.
That perfectly targets the downtown condominium cluster. If an entity is going to drain $930,000 a year from public school budgets, they need to be actively executing millions of dollars in highly visible, highly necessary historic restoration. You can't just pocket the public's cash because you happen to live in an old building.
Exactly. It forces the scale of the public subsidy to align proportionally with the scale of the public benefit.
So, bringing this all together for the listener, this deep dive into the Los Angeles Mills Act is much more than an exploration of a niche California property code. It serves as a masterclass in why public policies require relentless, ongoing auditing. Because a law meant to save crumbling architectural history accidentally created a $20 million slush fund for luxury condo owners in high-resource neighborhoods.
Yeah, and this evolution highlights a concept the source material explicitly defines as institutional sclerosis.
Institutional sclerosis.
Right. This raises an important question. Why do structurally broken programs like this persist for decades unchecked? It is driven by the political dynamic of concentrated benefits and diffuse costs. The 36 property owners receiving massive six-figure tax windfalls have a very strong, highly concentrated financial incentive to fight aggressively to maintain the status quo.
Because they are making an absolute fortune off the loophole.
Meanwhile, the cost, the $20 million in lost public revenue, is diffused across millions of taxpayers and hundreds of public schools. No individual taxpayer feels the loss acutely enough on a given Tuesday to march on City Hall and demand immediate reform, even though the aggregate long-term damage to city services is profound. But you know, knowledge is only valuable when applied. Recognizing this structural dynamic is the first step to dismantling it.
It really is. And that leaves you, the listener, with a final lingering question to mull over on your own. If a multi-million dollar loophole like this can hide in plain sight in Los Angeles for nearly 30 years, running on autopilot, what other invisible tax abatements or grandfathered clauses are baked right now into your own city or state's property codes?
It's a scary thought.
Are there other antiquated programs quietly draining your local public school funds simply because the administrative ledger is too long and the assessment math is too complex for anyone to bother reading? It really makes you wonder who else is walking out of the buffet with a bag full of Tupperware. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the source material. Keep looking beneath the surface of the policies in your own backyard, and we will catch you next time.